Okay, good afternoon, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it's October 20th. We have an exam coming up, I think, 1 week from today, Monday the 27th. And who can tell me what chapters are on the test?
7, 8, and 9.
And we're going to cover chapter 9 today. But before we start, I want to give you a pop quiz real quick. I want to show you a video, and you have to tell me what part of the central nervous system has the lesion. Okay? So, are you ready to watch the video?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, here's the video. Let's see if I have the sound up. Okay, so what part of the central nervous system has the lesion? Oh. It's an association between the medulla and the pons called the reticular activating formation or the reticular activating system, RAS. I think we talked about that last time. We talked about narcolepsy. Yeah, central nervous system. Okay, and if there is a lesion in that part of the brain, people can just fall asleep at any moment. I couldn't find the video of somebody falling asleep. There's some on YouTube, but I just didn't know if they were reputable sources. Okay. All right, so on to autonomic nervous system. All right, so let's get started with autonomic nervous system. In humans, depending on what causes the condition, yeah, the treatment can treat norepinephrine pathways sometimes. Sometimes some antidepressants are helpful. Sometimes amphetamine analogs are helpful. But the course of treatment usually is relatively long. It's usually about 6 months or so before any effect is noticed. And during that time, you don't know if you're prescribing the right drug or not. So, yeah, it's a little iffy. It's a little iffy course of treatment. Okay, so autonomic nervous system. What does the autonomic nervous system control? You should think of three things. What's one thing? Heart. Heart, what's another thing? Smooth muscle. And glands, right? The three effectors of the autonomic nervous system. Okay. All right, the autonomic nervous system manages our physiology just automatically, things we don't have to consciously think about, by regulating organs and organ systems and their smooth muscles and glands, but don't forget also cardiac muscle in here. Smooth muscle maintains a resting tone in the absence of nerve stimulation. So smooth muscle has a tendency to contract and even contract rhythmically without innervation. And when we take innervation away from smooth muscle, it becomes more sensitive. It becomes hyperactive. Right? We call that denervation hypersensitivity. Many types of smooth muscle are spontaneously active, and contract according to their own rhythm. They're autorhythmic in nature. They contract without autonomic nervous system input. So that just means that if one muscle cell in some part of a smooth organ that has smooth muscle, if one muscle cell contracts, they all have a tendency to follow that. So what can you tell me about the synapse between those cells? That if one depolarizes, they all depolarize together. What kind of synapse is that characteristic of? Is that going to be, what are the kinds of synapses that you're familiar with? There's chemical and electrical, and the kind that if one cell depolarizes and the whole rest of that organ depolarizes, that's usually due to an electrical synapse where a sodium current can go directly from one cell into another cell, causing depolarization. So autonomic nervous system input simply increases or decreases the intrinsic activity of smooth muscles that have these electrical synapses. All right, neurons of the autonomic nervous system. This first slide right here, part A, we see a skeletal muscle. So does that look like an autonomic nervous system to you, connecting up to that skeletal muscle? No, that's just a somatic motor neuron. And notice that the cell body of that somatic motor neuron is in the ventral horn, or the gray matter of the spinal cord, right? And then the axon goes through the ventral root all the way, one fiber to skeletal muscle. So there's one motor neuron from the spinal cord all the way to the effector organ. All right, the same thing for sensory neurons. There is one sensory neuron all the way from the sensory receptor into the spinal cord, going in the dorsal root, passing by the dorsal root ganglia, where it's going to synapse on an interneuron someplace here in the dorsal horn of the gray matter. All right, so this is a typical somatic. What's another name for somatic? It's going to be voluntary, right? So voluntary neuron right here, voluntary or somatic motor output. It has only one neuron from the spinal cord all the way to that effector organ, even though this muscle might be in your big toe someplace, right? Just one big long axon all the way. All right, we'll compare that or contrast that with the sympathetic nervous system, which is autonomic. All right, so in this particular case, the cell body for the motor neuron is going to be in the lateral horn of the gray matter, and this motor neuron comes all the way out through the ventral root, right, through the ventral root joins the spinal nerve, right, so where the dorsal and ventral root converge, that's what we call a spinal nerve, that's going to be outside the vertebral column. And then, right, it leaves the spinal nerve and it enters the sympathetic chain ganglia. Now, I'm sure all of you have looked at this in anatomy. The sympathetic chain ganglia are like auxiliary spinal cords that run lateral to the vertebral column. Sometimes we call these the paravertebral chain ganglia. Right? And look, right here, that neuron ends and it synapses with a second neuron. And that second neuron then might leave the sympathetic chain ganglia and go to the effector organ. So in order for sympathetic outflow to leave the central nervous system and find an effector organ, it requires how many neurons back to back? Two. But for a somatic pathway, it requires just a single neuron, right? Okay. So consequently, so this a group of nerve cell bodies, like this nerve cell body that we have right here, in this little bulge, we're going to have thousands or tens of thousands of nerve cell bodies. What do we call an accumulation or an aggregation of thousands of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system? What do we call that? As opposed to the central nervous system. That's a ganglion, right? Just like this is a ganglion here. It's a group of nerve cell bodies of what? A unipolar neuron. But these over here are multipolar neurons. Nonetheless, this is a ganglion, an autonomic ganglion. Okay. So the first neuron is what we call the preganglionic fiber. And the second neuron is what we call the postganglionic fiber. And this synapse right here is a chemical synapse. It's not an electrical synapse. And these synapses are run by acetylcholine. So the preganglionic fiber is what we call cholinergic. So we're familiar with that term. Furthermore, maybe you could tell me some other things about the difference between the preganglionic fiber and the postganglionic fiber. What else could you tell me about them from anatomy? One is myelinated and one is not myelinated. Which one is myelinated? The preganglionic is myelinated and the postganglionic is non-myelinated. And so the postganglionic is what? Is, in terms of impulse conduction, is slower, right? It is slower. All right, the other things probably you should be familiar with from anatomy are these two passageways right here, these two nerves that are either entering or leaving the sympathetic chain. And in this diagram, it's diagrammed correctly, right? This right here is the white ramus communicantes, and this is the gray ramus communicantes. The white ramus contains myelinated fibers that are entering the sympathetic chain, and the gray ramus communicantes is going to contain unmyelinated axons, and therefore it's going to look, what, gray as opposed to white. All right, and your textbook kind of interchanges this diagram a couple places, so I'll point out where they have it wrong in the next couple slides coming up. But this is the white ramus, this is the gray ramus right here. Okay, so be able to compare and contrast outflow in terms of pathways of a somatic pathway compared to an autonomic pathway. Somatic pathway has one neuron, it's always myelinated. An autonomic pathway has two neurons back to back. The preganglionic is myelinated, the postganglionic is non-myelinated. Also, the cell bodies are located in two different locations. Right, the cell body for somatic motor is in the ventral horn, and the cell body for sympathetic nerve is going to be in the lateral horn over here. Okay. Okay. So the sympathetic chain lie on either side of the vertebral column. So this postganglionic fiber has to go from the vertebral column all the way to the effector organ. So this postganglionic fiber is relatively long because it has to travel a long distance. So that's going to have some importance when we compare that to the parasympathetic nervous system. All right, so you should probably know that the autonomic nervous system has two divisions. And that might seem overly complicated to you. Okay, but why is this really a good thing? Because do you think your automobile having both a brake and a gas pedal is overly complicated? Or would you drive a car without both of those? Of course you wouldn't drive a car without both of those. It's not overly complicated, right? That's a necessary thing for you to go and stop at your destination. And the same thing for how your central nervous system controls organs inside your body. All right, so sympathetic and parasympathetic divisions are antagonistic to each other. All right, these coordinate physiology with what's going on inside your life and inside your person. The sympathetic mediates what we call the fight, flight, or stress reactions. The parasympathetic mediates the rest and repose, or the rest and digest nervous system. These are two opposite effects that you have in your body. All right, let's take a look at a slide of this. First, the sympathetic division. It's also called the thoracolumbar division because sympathetic outflow only comes from your central nervous systems from T1 to L2. So what do we mean by that? When I say T1, what does that mean? Thoracic one, right? That's just the spinal nerve between C7 and T1. That's the T1 nerve coming out between those two vertebrae. Okay. So it's going to, sympathetic outflow is going to leave the central nervous system only at these levels right here. So therefore, we call it thoracolumbar. Most end synapse on the postganglionics and the paravertebral ganglia, another name for that would be the sympathetic chain ganglia on either side of the vertebral column. And these ganglia are interconnected with ganglia that are superior to them or inferior to them. So even though a sympathetic nerve impulse will leave at one level, once it gets into the sympathetic chain, it can go up or it can go down different levels before it exits the sympathetic chain ganglia. And we'll show you a couple examples of that. All right, so don't forget, since we're talking about sympathetic, that's autonomic nervous system, there's going to be two nerves, right? So the preganglionic comes out, the spinal nerve then enters the white ramus communicante into the sympathetic chain. It can enter, go up or down a level, or it can actually synapse here and then leave via the gray ramus communicantes and then follow the spinal nerve to its destination. All right, sympathetic division is characterized by divergence and convergence, which causes sympathetic innervation to mostly act as a unit. That means that once a signal leaves a spinal nerve, right, it diverges into many nerves and then it comes back again, stimulating the whole sympathetic nervous system as a result of that. So let's look at an example of divergence right here. So here we have a sympathetic nerve, and is this going to be a motor nerve or sensory nerve? And how would you know? What root is this? Ventral root. What kind of activity do we see in a ventral root? Always, always, always. It's going to be motor. That's right. So here is sympathetic outflow, because motor means outflow, right? Efferent signal. And it enters the ventral root, then the spinal nerve. And then what should it do? It should actually go in the white ramus right here. So this is the incorrectly labeled diagram that's in your book, right? It should pass by the gray ramus. So this really is a gray ramus, not the white ramus. It should enter the white ramus into the sympathetic chain, right? And then what happens? Well, I see this trifurcation right here. It can leave through a splanchnic nerve. It can descend a level or two to some inferior chain ganglia, or it can go up a division or two and synapse in some sympathetic chain ganglia, in which case then it's going to elicit a response in a postganglionic fiber, either at the same level, like we see right here, right, or at a lower level or a higher level. And in this example right here, so here we see a divergence of the signal coming back together at a collateral ganglia. So there are two kinds of ganglia in the sympathetic nervous system. There are what we call the ganglia along the spinal cord, the sympathetic chain, or the paravertebral. Paravertebral means what? Para means along with the vertebral column. All right, and the second kind of ganglia is what we call a collateral ganglia. These are in front of the vertebral column. So a sympathetic outflow can actually pass through the sympathetic chain, going to a collateral ganglia someplace, where it then synapses on the postganglionic neuron. And again, this is going to be a non-myelinated fiber going to smooth muscle or the heart or a gland someplace in the body. So we see a lot of divergence in this kind of circuit, as well as convergence as well. All right, so this dotted line, what does that dotted line represent right here? What kind of fiber is that? How should we talk about that? It's a postganglionic fiber, and it is myelinated or non-myelinated? It's non-myelinated. All right, so the preganglionic fiber is a cholinergic fiber, but the postganglionic fiber is what we call adrenergic. And I maybe wrote that on the board, but I can't remember for sure. So when we say cholinergic, what is a neurotransmitter that's being used? Yeah, if it's cholinergic, it's acetylcholine. So I'll write that down. Cholinergic means it's using acetylcholine. And if it's adrenergic, what do we mean? We mean for sure not acetylcholine. We mean that it's going to be using norepinephrine. Norepinephrine as a neurotransmitter. Okay, so that's mostly the case. In most cases, you would be correct with that. There's only a few sympathetic postganglionic fibers that use acetylcholine. Maybe we'll look at an example of that. Okay. So this is what I said before. Some postganglionics do not synapse in the paravertebral ganglia. That would be the sympathetic chain, but just pass right through the sympathetic chain and go to outlying collateral ganglia. Like this is a collateral ganglia right here. But in every case, what can you tell me about sympathetic outflow? It's only thoracolumbar, and it still takes just two neurons to get from the spinal cord to the effector organ. Doesn't matter where the ganglia is. The two possible places for the ganglia are either in the paravertebral or the collateral ganglia. And acetylcholine is used in each one of these ganglia right here. An interesting exception to this is the adrenal gland. And in particular, the adrenal medulla is located in the adrenal gland on top of the kidneys. And that's what adrenal means. It means on top of the kidneys. And appears to be a modified collateral ganglion. Right? It secretes, or it has secretory cells that once they're depolarized, secrete about 85% epinephrine and about 15% norepinephrine into the blood in response to preganglionic stimulation. So, let's see what this next picture is. I guess I might have to just draw this out. Okay, so for sympathetic outflow, we've got spinal cord. Here's a cell body coming out the ventral root. All right, and then we have the sympathetic chain right here. And this nerve that's going to, what does a kidney look like? Kidney kind of looks like that. Well, it's more like that. Oh, that's looking better all the time. Okay. And then where's the adrenal gland? The adrenal gland is right here, on top of it. And where's the adrenal medulla at? What part of an organ is the medulla? That's the deep part, right? Or if you want to say middle, that's fine. So the adrenal medulla is right here. So we said for for any kind of autonomic outflow, how many neurons make up a pathway to the effector organ? Two, right? All right. So here we see a sympathetic nerve leaving, passing right through the sympathetic chain, going to the adrenal medulla. Now, how many nerves is that? That just looks like one, right? So this right here is what we call a splanchnic nerve. Splanchnic nerve, any kind of nerve between a sympathetic chain and a collateral ganglia is what we call a splanchnic nerve. There are different kinds of splanchnic nerves depending on what level we're talking about. All right, but inside the adrenal medulla, what do we call this nerve right here? This is splanchnic nerve, right? But more generally speaking, this is the preganglionic. Preganglionic neuron, and then there's usually a postganglionic neuron. But in this particular case, for the adrenal medulla, here is the postganglionic cell, right here. It's really not a neuron, because it just stays right inside the adrenal medulla. So here is this cell. Here's an adrenal medulla cell. I think we call this a chromaffin cell. And when this is stimulated by the preganglionic fiber, there are vesicles inside this cell, right? And these vesicles secrete epinephrine and norepinephrine directly into the circulation. So norepinephrine is your sympathetic neurotransmitter, but in this particular case, when it's secreted by a chromaffin cell inside the adrenal medulla, it gets picked up by the circulatory system, and then where does it go? Where does the circulatory system go? Everywhere in your body. So it's delivering these sympathetic nervous system stimulants everywhere in your body. So in this particular case, these chromaffin cells are what we call modified postganglionic cells. All right, so that's really the only exception to always having two neurons in a sympathetic or autonomic nervous system pathway. But you see it's just modified because this little blue dot right here represents what? That's really the postganglionic cell. But it's not really acting as a neuron. What's it really acting as? It's acting as, since it's secreting a product that gets picked up by the blood, we haven't talked about this yet, it's acting as an endocrine cell. Because epinephrine and norepinephrine in this particular case are acting as a hormone. All right, so it's just a modified nervous cell. So this is always a good example that shows the interrelationship between the nervous system, in particular the sympathetic nervous system, and the endocrine system. And the nervous system and endocrine system work together to control functions in your body. And a lot of times in classes, we don't study the nervous system and then the endocrine system like we do in this class. We study them together because they function together. We actually study them as a neuroendocrine system. Because they work together. As a matter of fact, you can't really separate them in a few parts of the body. And this is just one example, the adrenal medulla. All right, so epinephrine is made by methylating norepinephrine. And don't forget, norepinephrine comes from tyrosine, an amino acid. But what kind of amino acid is that again? That's an essential amino acid. You have to have that in your diet. All right, so just by methylating this one proton right here, this one group on this amino group, that turns it into epinephrine. And this then will exert sympathetic activity in many parts of the body as a hormone, not as a neurotransmitter. But don't forget that the adrenal medulla even secretes a little bit of norepinephrine. Okay. All right, well, let's focus our attention on the parasympathetic division. This is called the cranial sacral division because its outflow comes from cranial nerves and from sacral nerves. So, again, tell me where sympathetic innervation originates from. How does sympathetic outflow leave your central nervous system? What levels? T1 to L2, right? So that's thoracolumbar. So parasympathetic outflow comes from cranial nerves and sacral nerves. All right, so let's take a look at probably the most important cranial nerve is the vagus nerve, number 10. It innervates the heart, lungs, esophagus, stomach, pancreas, upper half of your digestive system. The preganglionic fibers from S2, what does that S stand for? Sacrum 2, 3, and 4 innervate the lower half of the large intestine, rectum, urinary, and reproductive systems. All right, so here is a composite diagram. So let's look at this diagram just a little bit. So the red right here is which nervous system? That is sympathetic. And the blue is parasympathetic. All right, so you should be able to contrast those. The sympathetic leave and go into the sympathetic chain. And the solid nerves, the solid colored nerves, are the preganglionic fibers. The dotted lines represents the postganglionic fibers. So the solid color are myelinated, the dotted lines are non-myelinated. So you can see that some of the ganglia or some of the cells synapse in the sympathetic chain, right? Because here you can see the preganglionic fiber and postganglionic fibers. Others pass through the sympathetic chain and go to a collateral ganglion someplace before they synapse. Right, and now you can see the postganglionic fibers. And all except for which one? Which one doesn't synapse in the sympathetic chain or the collateral ganglia? Okay, the one that goes to the adrenal medulla. See it passing right through? Going all the way to the adrenal medulla because the postganglionic fiber is really inside the adrenal medulla and it's been converted into an endocrine cell. The neurotransmitter used in the sympathetic ganglia is acetylcholine. So all these solid colored nerves right here are cholinergic, but these dotted lines are all, where's my little laser? Oh, I don't have it on me. Is what? Adrenergic. They're adrenergic. They're releasing norepinephrine. Okay, so what is, all right, let's trace parasympathetic outflow. In particular, maybe let's look at something going to the heart. All right, so here is cranial nerve number 10, and the solid line represents what? What kind of fiber? Different ways we could think about it. It's parasympathetic, right? But how else might you want to think about that solid colored nerve right there? That's the preganglionic. Right, and the preganglionic here is also going to release acetylcholine. Now, where does it go? This preganglionic fiber goes all the way to the effector organ. So that's an extremely long neuron, much longer than the preganglionics in the sympathetic nervous system. Right, the preganglionics in the sympathetic nervous system are short, relatively short. The preganglionic fibers in the parasympathetic system are relatively long. All right, and let's see. I don't know if I can see it on the heart diagram right here, but this is a ganglion right on the surface of the heart. So there is a postganglionic cell right here, but it is what? Microscopic in length. It's very, very short. So I'm not sure we can see it. Maybe you can see it from your vantage point. But I can see one here on the uterus. All right, I can see a very short postganglionic cell right here on the uterus, and that's parasympathetic nerve right there. It's a parasympathetic outflow. So for parasympathetic postganglionic fibers, they are microscopic in length compared to very long for sympathetic neurons. The postganglionic parasympathetic are also always acetylcholine. So these are cholinergic neurons. All right, so there's a lot about the nervous system, the architecture and the neurotransmitters that they're using that you should appreciate. So I tell you what, somebody should ask me a question about what's going on right here. This is kind of a review from anatomy, depending on what level you actually had to know this in anatomy. Right, but so when we talk about autonomic nervous system, you got the preganglionic fiber, postganglionic fiber. It's issued from two different parts of the central nervous system, depending on whether it's parasympathetic or sympathetic, and it uses two different kinds of neurotransmitters, depending on whether it's a preganglionic fiber or a postganglionic fiber, and which nervous system it's involved in. All right, so here you see on the heart, you see two fibers, or two nervous systems. You got the parasympathetic and the sympathetic right here. So what's the beauty of having both stimulation via the sympathetic nervous system and inhibition via the parasympathetic nervous system? What's the beauty of that? Okay, antagonistic control. And one of the things that happens in all control systems is that there is noise. And noise can act like a signal. So if you only had one nerve fiber going to the heart, right, and there was some aberrant signals, if there was some noise, for instance, on this parasympathetic neuron right here going to the heart, it would slow the heart rate down, right? If there was some kind of noisy signal in this parasympathetic nerve fiber right here, it would slow the heart down. But since we have a double-ended system here that's balanced, if we put the same noise signal in the parasympathetic and the sympathetic, right, and they arrive at the heart the same time, if it's the same signal, right? And it's a meaningless, noisy signal. What's going to be the effect on the heart? Is it going to slow the heart down? Or is it going to slow the heart up? I mean, speed the heart up. So let's inject the same false signal, which is what we call noise, into both the parasympathetic and sympathetic, and have it sent to the heart. What's the effect on the heart going to be? It's not going to be like that. Okay. Well, if you take an aberrant signal, all right, and the parasympathetic signal is going to slow the heart down, and the sympathetic signal is going to speed the heart up, they cancel each other out, and then you have what? Nice precise control over your heart, because that noise has a tendency to cancel out. All right. So that's one really nice thing about having an antagonistic control system. Okay, I'm looking for a blood vessel. I don't see a blood vessel. All right, but we have blood vessels here. All right, so here's a table that shows the antagonistic effects of the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system. All right, for instance, on the eye, sympathetic nervous system dilates the pupil and parasympathetic constricts the pupil. Because we have a couple different muscles in the iris that we're going to talk about when we get to sense organs. But you can see that these effects are antagonistic to each other. Okay, what about salivary glands? Sympathetic is stimulatory. Oh, and so is parasympathetic. That's not a good one that I wanted to show you. How about stomach? Sympathetic decreases secretions. Oh, wait, I'm reading this all wrong. All right. Parasympathetic increases stomach secretions. Right? Increases. So parasympathetic stimulation is stimulatory on digestion, and it is actually inhibitory. Sympathetic is inhibitory on digestion. Okay, let's look at the heart, the rate. Sympathetic increases, parasympathetic decreases. Sympathetic increases, this is a speed of conduction within the heart, and the heart rate, right? Sympathetic increases, parasympathetic decreases. Blood vessels, this is an interesting one to look at. Sympathetic stimulation causes constriction, right? Parasympathetic almost has no effect except for one spot in the body, right? And that's the penis, and that causes dilation. So let's just forget about this for the moment. So in this particular case, we see that sympathetic nervous system goes to most blood vessels in the body, but parasympathetic hardly goes anywhere in the body. And what kind of pathology is very common in people having to do with vasoconstriction or vasodilation? And we haven't gotten to the circulatory system, so I'm going to have to describe this just a little bit. Okay, so for instance, vasoconstriction is what? Making blood vessel diameter smaller, squeezing down on a diameter of a blood vessel. So what happens to blood pressure when vasoconstriction takes place? Blood pressure goes up, right? All right, and when blood vessels dilate, blood pressure is going to decrease as a result of that. Well, so what kind of condition is prevalent and it has to do with blood pressure? What's that disease process called? Hypertension. All right, so hypertension is high blood pressure. It's characterized by what? Overconstriction or overdilation of blood vessels? Overconstriction of blood vessels. All right, and we can see here that the autonomic nervous system really only goes to blood vessels, and it only has one effect, which is what? Vasoconstriction. So any kind of autonomic nervous system activity is going to cause vasoconstriction, which translates into what kind of phenomena in terms of blood pressure? Hypertension, right? And so I would suggest that probably hypertension is such a difficult problem to solve because it's not under antagonistic control. Only the sympathetic nervous system goes to blood vessels. So any kind of activation of the autonomic nervous system is going to cause vasoconstriction and hypertension as a result of that. Okay, if there was some kind of errant signal, if all blood vessels had parasympathetic innervation, then there's a chance that they could cancel out and hypertension would not occur. So what do we call that when an organ is just under control of the sympathetic nervous system or the parasympathetic and not both? If it's both, it's antagonistic. If it's just one, it's called tonic control, right? And that's problematic, and here's a perfect example of that. Okay, bronchioles, this is an important one to know. Bronchioles, these are airway passageways in the lungs. They can dilate or they can constrict. Sympathetic causes dilation, and parasympathetic causes constriction. All right, so if we want to dilate somebody's bronchioles, right, what would we have to give? We'd have to give a sympathetic agonist, a drug that acts like the sympathetic nervous system to dilate their bronchioles, for instance, if somebody's having an asthmatic attack. All right, so now let's look at some neurotransmitters. This is a nice synopsis of the autonomic nervous system. So don't forget, it's both sympathetic and parasympathetic. And in the ganglia here, what's the neurotransmitter that you see in each one of these ganglia? It's acetylcholine. And so what kind of ganglia is this right here? Is this sympathetic or is this parasympathetic? And how would you know? It's parasympathetic because yeah, it originates from a cranial nerve. And this one here is a sympathetic because it's thoracolumbar, so sympathetic, sympathetic, sympathetic. And then this one here is parasympathetic because it originates from a sacral spinal nerve. All right, and so in each one of these cases, you see two neurons going from the central nervous system to the effector organ. Here's the preganglionic, here's the postganglionic fiber, except for innervation to the adrenal medulla. You only have one preganglionic fiber, and the cells of the adrenal medulla are acting like the postganglionic fibers of a sympathetic nervous system. All right, so for parasympathetic, the preganglionic as well as the postganglionic fiber are cholinergic. As a matter of fact, I'm sure this is an exam figure because it's such a nice synopsis of the nervous system. So both are cholinergic. For the sympathetic nervous system, the preganglionics are cholinergic, but the postganglionic are adrenergic. They use norepinephrine on the effector organs. And notice here's a blood vessel, and it's only receiving sympathetic stimulation. And what else? You can see the non-myelinated fiber compared to the myelinated fiber. And this also shows you the relative length of the postganglionic fibers. The postganglionic fibers of the parasympathetic nervous system are short. The postganglionic fibers for the sympathetic nervous system are relatively long. Okay, so that kind of just shows everything. Except for the adrenal medulla, right? We don't really call the secretion of the adrenal medulla cells neurotransmitters because they get picked up directly by the blood, so these are more properly called hormones or neurohormones in this particular case. So both epinephrine and norepinephrine. And then these will carry that sympathetic signal into the circulation, which is going to carry it everywhere in the body. All right, well, I think you're familiar with the neuromuscular junction and a typical kind of synapse in the body, chemical synapse, as it relates to the axon terminus and a synapse. Synapses in the autonomic nervous system are quite a bit different. They don't occur just at the axon terminus, but they occur along a length of an axon. So each one of these swellings right here contain synaptic vesicles, and when an action potential moves down this axon, well, here's a cell body, when it moves down this axon, it's going to cause release of neurotransmitter from each one of these varicosities right here. So that's a huge structural difference because, for instance, if this was a somatic motor neuron, you would find this swelling only at the, what, the Bouton terminale at the end of the axon. So neurotransmitter release is fairly similar. It's controlled in a fairly similar fashion, but it's released through the whole length of this axon. And it can either be a sympathetic axon or a parasympathetic axon. So these kinds of synapses are what we call synapses en passant, or synapses in passing. And so one neuron is going to release excitatory neurotransmitter and the other inhibitory. And then the target cell right here is going to balance out the effects of the two kinds of neurotransmitter that are being released. So let's see if I can see this picture right here. Well, this looks like a nice G protein coupled receptor. All right, so that's a sympathetic receptor for norepinephrine. And these just look pretty much like sodium channels, ligand-gated sodium channels, cholinergic, but it doesn't necessarily really say what kind they are. But they actually, these kind of look like G-protein coupled receptors as well. All right, but it's going, these two different neurons will elicit and produce these antagonistic effects, producing balance and control in this smooth muscle cell. All right, so adrenergic stimulation can cause both excitation and inhibition depending on the tissue. All right, so from sympathetic nerves, these are adrenergic, they're going to be releasing norepinephrine. How is it that one neurotransmitter, namely norepinephrine, how is it that it can produce variable effects in different effector organs? How can one kind of neurotransmitter produce different effects in different effector organs? Just like acetylcholine. How can acetylcholine be stimulatory or inhibitory depending on the organ? Okay, and the answer is because different tissues will place different kinds of receptors in the cell membrane. So the way that you explain that is that, oh, well, there are different receptors in different tissues. Therefore, one kind of neurotransmitter can have different effects on different tissues. All right. There are different even subtypes of receptors for the same neurotransmitter. There are two major kinds of receptors for adrenergic fibers. I don't know who that was. Was that my boss peeking in? No? Okay. All right, there are two major subtypes of receptors for the sympathetic nervous system, and these are called alpha receptors and beta receptors, and these are all going to be adrenergic receptors. All right, so if there's probably one slide and a figure that you should memorize from this class and never forget if you're ever going to get into some kind of clinical practice, this would be it. All right, because we work with these things day in and day out. All right, different kinds of receptor types and how to control various processes in people with various kinds of pharmaceutical agents. All right, furthermore, there are different kinds of alpha receptors and different kinds of beta receptors. So there are what we call alpha 1 and alpha 2. There's beta 1 and beta 2 kinds of receptors. Nonetheless, all of these receptors are G protein coupled, working through a second messenger system. Right? And they might open up ion channels or they just might change metabolism inside the cell. One would be an ionotropic kind of receptor and the other kind of a metabotropic kind of receptor. All right, so alpha receptors use calcium as a second messenger inside the cell, and beta receptors use cyclic AMP. So that might be handy for you to memorize too. Beta, cyclic AMP, and alpha, calcium. All right, so let's look on some effects on different organs, and you're going to see that sympathetic stimulation is not always stimulatory on these different organs. And why do you think that might be? Because they have different kinds of receptors in them. Some might have alpha 1, some might have alpha 2, some might have beta 2. All right, so let's take a look at some of these receptor types. All right, On the eye, contraction of radial fibers of the iris dilates the pupils, but still that is a stimulation because it causes contraction of fibers that pull the iris open, right? That's an alpha 1 kind of receptor. All right, and let's find another alpha 1 receptor here, skin and visceral vessels, so blood vessels. When the alpha 1, it causes constriction. Right, so alpha 1 usually causes constriction of smooth muscle. It's excitatory on smooth muscle. It's going to cause smooth muscle to contract. All right, so that's an alpha 1. Here's another alpha 1. Arterioles constrict due to sympathetic nerve activity. All right, so what's the mediator of an alpha 1? Is it going to be a cyclic AMP or a calcium signal inside the cell? It's a calcium signal inside the cell. All right, let's look at the heart. The heart, increased heart rate and contraction. I would call that stimulation, not inhibition. That's due to a beta 1 receptor. All right, that's the only beta 1 that we have right here. Okay, and what about beta 2? Do you see any beta 2s? A good place to look for beta 2s are in the lungs and bronchioles. And we said, what, that sympathetic stimulation of bronchioles causes dilation of bronchioles, makes it easier to breathe, and sympathetic stimulation, all right, when it binds epinephrine, all right, that's a beta 2 receptor that inhibits the smooth muscle, that causes smooth muscle to relax in bronchioles. So that's a beta 2 function. And in some parts of the body, arterioles will dilate. Other parts of the arterioles in skeletal muscle vessels will dilate, and other times they might constrict, depending on exactly which muscles they are. All right, and I'll relate this to the different responses generally to the autonomic nervous systems in just a second. Furthermore, okay, glycogenolysis and the release of glucose from the liver is controlled both by alpha 1 and beta 2 receptors because these can change metabolism inside the cell, all right, and just what, stimulating glycogenolysis. What the heck is glycogenolysis again? Glycogenolysis, it's the breaking down of glycogen and then releasing glucose into the blood, for instance, when you're in a fasted state. All right, so these are pretty important to know. Now, here's another exam figure. All right, so this will help you understand what's going on right here. So we have, what the heck do we have right here? Well, how many neurons do you see back to back from central nervous system to some kind of effector organ? 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2. So automatically, can you tell me, is this autonomic or somatic? What does somatic mean? Means just voluntary motor. All right, so this is not it. This is always going to be an autonomic scheme of some kind. And in particular, we have one example of a parasympathetic outflow and three examples of sympathetic outflow right here. In every case, all right, what is the preganglionic fiber? It's always going to release acetylcholine. Right, and the receptors in the postganglionic fibers within the ganglia are all going to be nicotinic acetylcholine receptors. And what's the effect of a nicotinic receptor when it's stimulated? What kind of receptor is it? I think that's an exam figure. It's a ligand-gated ion channel. So when acetylcholine binds to that channel, it's going to open it up, and sodium can enter the cell. What's that going to cause? Depolarization. That's a stimulus for the postganglionic fiber. So since these are all of the nicotinic type, acetylcholine is always going to be stimulatory on these postganglionic fibers. It's always going to be stimulatory because it's a nicotinic kind of receptor. What is the other kind of receptor for cholinergic systems? Could be muscarinic. Right, and muscarinic could be excitatory or inhibitory, but nicotinic is always excitatory. Okay. All right, so now let's look at the postganglionic fibers. for the parasympathetic nervous system, 99% of the time, it's going to be acetylcholine. Now, this is going to stimulate a muscarinic receptor. It's not going to stimulate a nicotinic receptor. But in the autonomic nervous system, it's always going to be muscarinic. Now, what about somatic nervous system? What's the receptor type, for instance, on skeletal muscle? Is motor neuron stimulation, can it ever produce inhibition of a skeletal muscle? And the answer is, you know what? It can never do that. Right? Because when you consciously give your nervous system a command to contract a muscle, that muscle can never decide for itself whether it's going to contract or not. It's just going to follow the command of that motor neuron and it's going to contract. So it only has nicotinic receptors. So at the neuromuscular junction, that receptor is nicotinic. But on various glands, for instance, acetylcholine can be inhibitory because it could be of that muscarinic type that is inhibitory. And I tell you what, maybe you could even tell me an organ in the body that is inhibited when it receives parasympathetic stimulation or acetylcholine, when you place it on that organ. What organ is inhibited when you put acetylcholine on it because it has these inhibitory muscarinic receptors? And everybody knows, but you're just not making the connection yet, or maybe I just heard somebody say it, and that is your heart, right? Your parasympathetic nervous system inhibits your heart. It slows your heart down. Because it doesn't have nicotinic receptors, your heart has muscarinic receptors. And these muscarinic receptors, when they open up potassium channels, which slow the heart rate down. So do we have that? We don't have heart on here anywhere. But that might be a good example. Muscarinic, all right, will slow the heart down. All right, let's turn our attention to sympathetic nerves. All right, so the preganglionic is cholinergic. The postganglionic is adrenergic. It's going to release norepinephrine. This is going to stimulate alpha-1 receptors. And alpha-1 is primarily what? Stimulatory or inhibitory? Alpha-1 is stimulatory. It's going to cause constriction or contraction of smooth muscle. So vasoconstriction in blood vessels, and blood vessels in the skin. Or maybe sympathetic outflow is going to find its way to the heart. What kind of receptors do we have in the heart? We've got the beta-1 kinds of receptors, and it's stimulatory on beta-1. It's going to increase heart rate and contractility. So if acetylcholine opens up potassium channels, guess what the beta-1 receptors do? They're probably going to open up sodium channels because it's going to have the opposite effect. So it's going to be stimulatory on the heart. All right. Another example of sympathetic stimulation. All right. So again, the preganglionic is cholinergic. The postganglionic is adrenergic. And in this particular case, it's going to go to bronchioles. And the bronchioles have beta-2 receptors. And what's the effect of norepinephrine on beta-2? It's going to be inhibitory on smooth muscle of bronchioles, and that's going to cause bronchodilation. So it's going to be easier to breathe, bronchodilation. So here, this is a really good cheat sheet that you just got to memorize because it's an exam figure. So you could probably answer a lot of questions on the test just by having this in your mind. So if you can label it, if you can learn it by labeling, that's fine. But if you have to draw it out on a blank piece of paper 5 or 6 times so that you know the receptor type and the tissue and what the effect is down over here, then, okay, that's what you have to do, all right? So this is something that you'll just use basically the rest of your life if you end up in some kind of clinical practice, okay? Drugs that promote actions of neurotransmitters are called agonists. That means that they work in the same fashion as a neurotransmitter like acetylcholine or norepinephrine. Drugs that inhibit the actions of a neurotransmitter are what we call antagonists in this particular case. All right, and so for instance, maybe we would like to give a drug that's going to work on dilating somebody's bronchioles when they're having trouble breathing. So we want to mimic what a sympathetic drug is going to be, a sympathetic agonist, but we've got to be really careful and like to design drugs that work primarily on the beta 2 receptors but have no effect on beta 1 or alpha 1 kinds of receptors, because we don't want to mess around with somebody's heart rate, right? We just want to dilate somebody's airways. We don't want to affect their heart rate. We don't want to have effects on changing their blood pressure, right? So when we design a drug, we like to have a very specific effect on one of these receptor types so that there's no cross-reactivity, so that we're just treating one symptom and not messing with somebody's whole physiology. Okay. All right, acetylcholine, in terms of the cholinergic system, and acetylcholine is used at all motor neuron synapses. So this would be the somatic nervous system, not autonomic nervous system. It's all preganglionics. So don't forget, even the sympathetic and parasympathetic are cholinergic, and parasympathetic postganglionics. These are all cholinergic neurons. And cholinergic receptors have two main subtypes, the nicotinic and muscarinic. And we've talked about this already. Nicotinic are stimulated by nicotine. Muscarinic are stimulated by muscarine. That's from a poisonous mushroom. And these can have opposite effects. Nicotinic are always stimulatory. They're going to open sodium channels. Muscarinic can be inhibitory or excitatory, depending on the particular tissue. Nicotinic are always ligand-gated ion channels, the sodium channel. Muscarinic work through G-protein coupled receptors. So they're not just a ligand-gated ion channel, but they work through a G-protein kind of receptor. And who's seen this before? Okay, so if you've ever gone to Blackboard, I pasted this picture into Blackboard just so that it would sort of make sense to you before we got to it in lecture. All right, so this is on the first page of Blackboard. So we've got two different kinds of receptor types. All right, we've got the nicotinic and muscarinic. On the postsynaptic membrane of all autonomic ganglia, all neuromuscular junctions, and even some central nervous systems, this is what? This is a ligand-gated sodium channel, primarily sodium. Some potassium does leave, but primarily the effect is sodium entering the cell. We call that depolarization when sodium enters. And is that stimulatory or excitatory? Yeah, that's excitatory. Why do you consider that excitatory? Because when something depolarizes, what happens? The resting membrane potential drifts up toward threshold. Right, and when threshold happens, then you can stimulate another action potential. All right, and don't forget, on this particular channel, it requires two acetylcholines to bind to it before it will go through a conformation change. Muscarinic types. We see that there are a couple different muscarinic types, and in your lifetime, I don't know how many different kinds of muscarinic, just like you've learned alpha 1 and alpha 2, beta 1 and beta 2, there's probably going to be about 4 or 5 different major kinds of muscarinic type receptors. In this class, I think you should just know that they can either be inhibitory or excitatory. So at least know that there's two different kinds of muscarinic receptor types. But in any case, they are all G-protein coupled receptors that influence ion channels by the dissociation of these various kinds of subunits. So for instance, if a subunit dissociates of the G protein and it bumps into a potassium channel, causes it to open, that's going to hyperpolarize the cell and take RMP farther away from threshold, that's going to inhibit the cell. All right, but if on the other hand, in the membrane there are sodium channels or maybe even calcium channels that open up when they bind to the alpha or the beta gamma subunit, right? That's going to cause depolarization, sodium can enter. And then there is another scheme, which we see right here. Maybe you'll have a cell that normally has a potassium channel that is very leaky. All right, so you might have a cell that is pretty quiet because it's being hyperpolarized all the time. But once acetylcholine binds to its receptor, right, it's going to close this potassium channel. Now, what is that like? If the potassium channel is open, all right, so let's go back to this case. If the potassium channel is open, what's happening to the resting membrane potential? It is hyperpolarizing, right? It's moving farther away from threshold. But now, let's close this leak channel right here, like what we see. And if we stop potassium from leaving, what happens to the resting membrane potential? It actually drifts back up to threshold. So by closing potassium channels that are normally open, that's another way of depolarizing a cell. All right, so this is an interesting case of depolarization. So in this slide right here, we see that a cell can be excited or stimulated in one of three ways. Either opening a sodium channel, opening a calcium channel, or closing an already existing open potassium channel. So these three different things possibly can happen depending on what is placed in the membrane right here. All right, so opening a sodium, opening a calcium, or closing a potassium channel, all are going to depolarize the cell and stimulate it. Okay. So here's a synopsis of some cholinergic receptors. I don't think I have this in the study guide for you to know about, but it is? Oh, it is. Okay, great. Let's look it over then. Okay, we got a couple minutes. All right, so what about nicotinic? Let's start with, nicotinic channels. Nicotinic are always going to be ligand-gated ion channels, and it's always going to be for sodium. So when it binds acetylcholine, and this is true for skeletal muscle as well as autonomic ganglia, it's going to be what? Causing depolarization, which is what? That's depolarizing a cell is stimulatory. So all nicotinic receptors are stimulatory because it causes depolarization in those cells. Okay. Muscarinic type receptors. For instance, in the heart. Let's go to the heart. All right, so here is an M2 type receptor. And don't forget, muscarinic receptors are always G protein coupled type receptors. And in the heart, it causes hyperpolarization, slowing the rate of spontaneous depolarization. When we get into the heart, you'll see what that means. But if it hyperpolarizes, that's going to be inhibitory, right? Because acetylcholine activates G-protein-coupled receptors, opening potassium channels. And when you open a potassium channel, that's going to hyperpolarize the cell or inhibit it. All right, what about some smooth muscles and glands? Again, depolarization and contraction of smooth muscle. So acetylcholine activates G-protein coupled receptors, opening calcium channels. Oh, when we get to muscles, I'll want you to know that. All right, so calcium then is the signal for contraction inside smooth muscle, right, by increasing cytosolic calcium. So these receptors right here increase cytosolic calcium that not only causes depolarization, but that's the signal for contraction of smooth muscle inside the cell, that calcium signal. Okay, other kinds of neurotransmitters. We're not too interested in other kinds of neurotransmitters in this class. Some postganglionic neurons of the autonomic nervous system, okay, and this can be sympathetic or parasympathetic, do not use norepinephrine or acetylcholine. We call these non-adrenergic, non-cholinergic fibers. Some maybe use ATP or nitric oxide. And nitric oxide, I think I mentioned this before, causes smooth muscle relaxation in many tissues. All right, so just sometime in your career, just don't have your heart set on exactly two kinds of neurotransmitters or two kinds of receptors, either cholinergic or adrenergic in the autonomic nervous system. There might be times when you have to learn about some other kinds of neurotransmitters in the autonomic nervous system. All right, so most visceral organs receive both innervation of the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. That's dual innervation. The two branches are antagonistic to each other, for instance, as in controlling heart rate. And I think that's really important because if there is some kind of noise, comparable noise, in both of these nervous systems, both the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system, its action on the effector organ will cancel out, and the activity of that organ won't drift away from a useful set point, like we see, for instance, in hypertension. All right, so that's it for the autonomic nervous system. So the important figures for you to know for sure is this one right here, because it talks about different kinds of receptors, different kinds of either adrenergic or cholinergic systems, and what the effect is on the target tissue, depending on the receptor type that's there. All right, so what kind of receptor is usually excitatory for the adrenergic system? Okay, excitatory would be alpha 1. Which one is usually going to be inhibitory? Is going to be the beta 2. All right, and the beta 1 is also excitatory, so alpha 1, beta 1 are excitatory. And notice we haven't mentioned alpha 2 receptors. And that's because that's even a little bit more complicated. Sometimes they're either stimulatory or excitatory. And that receptor system can be used for regulating blood pressure as well. Not in the effector organ, but in the central nervous system, actually. All right, so that's it for autonomic nervous system. So we're going to move on to the next chapter next time, which is, who knows what the next one is? Is it peripheral nervous system? No, it's going to be endocrinology, I think. Endocrine. No, senses. Ah, sensory physiology. That's fun. That's fun, but we're going to have to look at different receptor types for the sensory nervous system as well. Yeah? This one right here. How much of that do you have to know? I would like you to know, you know, when you get into the next chapter, you're going to know the iris and the ciliary muscle, but for this chapter, I want you to know blood vessels and the heart and I want you to know something about glycogenolysis, but I don't know if I see it on here. Do you have liver? Liver. Okay. Stimulation of glycogen hydrolysis. So sympathetic stimulation, what's the effect of sympathetic stimulation on the liver in terms of blood glucose? It increases blood glucose. Right.
Heart, blood vessels, and liver.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's a week from today.